Agriculture and Veterans Ominous Budget Conference Committee will come to order. Apologize for the time schedule, but longer in our session than I thought, so we're going to move right along and do is hopefully get them all done. And we're going to start right off, and first will be Veterans and Military Affairs. And the first one would be the Suicide Prevention Study and Hotline, and that's on page R22. Patty Fritz, she's here. She's welcome to speak if you like. And we have Colonel Alan Smith, our National Guard, and Mike Belusi, Department Commissioner. So they will start. We'll start right away.
Requirements. but will not catch all soldiers, especially those from some of the other services. Section 1, Subdivision 3 of this bill, which provides counseling services in underserved areas of the state, is currently not funded by either body, but offers an exceptional opportunity to support service members if funding should become available. And finally, the Adjutant General welcomes the opportunity to share his perspective and report to the committee in conjunction with Veterans Affairs, excuse me, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, of the needs of current veterans from Operation Rocky Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. This is an important aspect to ensure our retirees and returning veterans are gaining the services they need to help in their transition. And the funding is adequate for that.
Mr. Chair, members, Michael Police, Minnesota Department of Affairs, despite the National Guard and Military Affairs, our department is very supportive of this language and making some efforts towards realizing the initiative already. This is part of a work group of the Governor's Beyond the Overwritten Task Force. So we've been meeting with experts trying to develop what the program would look like, and we've come a long way already. DHS has similar programs with their senior linkage line, facilities linkage line, rotating and creating a veteran linkage line. It would be manned 24/7. We have a benefits unit in our department that exists already with five, we've increased that to six benefits workers who are trained in veterans benefits. They would be answering the line throughout the day. After hours, it would go over to what we partner with Crisis Connection. They're master's level social workers who could receive any types of crisis, but we're also going to train them in the referral process. So it really will be a one-stop shop, 24/7, not just a hotline of crisis intervention as well. The funding level would be adequate to help us do this endeavor, and we wouldn't require any additional staff.
Members of the Senate, ask questions if you don't quite understand it, because we were all done before these. Mm-hmm. Before these.
Mr. Chair, I got a question.
Sure.
I don't have a question, but just to point out, also you see R22 on your agenda. Also, page R68 in the back has language in there also pertaining to the study, which is the other part of this. Is these folks at the table and others are going to sit down over the summer and come back to us with a report in November on how we're going to handle the mental health treatment and ongoing problems we may encounter over a number of years. And so that language is also in here, and it's in the back in the statutory language section, R68.
Questions? Thank you very much, and we will be moving right along. We'll go to. Thank you for coming. Next one is the Starbase Minnesota program, and that is on page R70. Kim Van Wee, Executive Director of Starbase Program, Minnesota National Guard.
Experiments using the resources of the Air Force resources for Minnesota National school day along with their whole class and teacher, and they participate in the consensus of the class. We pre- and post-class the students and measure gains in knowledge and skills and interest in science and technology. This program is really interesting to learn about. We have a long waiting list of schools waiting to attend, and that was the And that's just no advertising. I don't know how many of you are aware of Saturday anymore. It's not beautiful, so I don't know. But among the schools we serve, we will be back year after year and more and more. Last spring, the State Finance Committee came out on a field trip to look at Saturday's post-op and do the experiments with the CPU and see the integration of math and science. And they're extremely impressed. In fact, Marty Deeper said, boy, this 15 minutes of watching stuff is really hard while people are playing in all high school. So, it was a great compliment. The $25,000 that you see on there for longitudinal study, that is so we can find more information about the impact. We have a lot of information on that, but done immediately with the students. We even know what's going on 3 to 5 months after students' participation starts. In fact, they're really seeing their knowledge and excitement about science and math, and they go back to their school 3 to 5 months later to measure that. But what we don't know for sure is the long-term impact. Are they going into any advanced field? Are they taking advantage of coursework in science and math? So there's an additional $25,000 there for long-term study. We're pretty sure that kids that attempt Saturday are going to do better than I'm going to ask for now if they don't. The study will prove that, and with those results, we hope to be able to go to a community funded appropriate foundation to find the extra cost to be able to build the facilities and be able to support the other kinds of students. Are there any questions?
So we have a couple, but first I want to make a comment. I know something about this, but not a lot about this. First looked at it, I thought it was another Minneapolis-St. Paul school project. Last night, Representative Hamilton and myself were over at the pension committee, and Representative Phyllis Kahn gave us this book. Now I figured a connection here, because when you look at it, it's National Guard. All of it. So it's intriguing to me, but I have a question I need to ask you. And that would be, after they do this design work for their expansion, where will they get the funding for the actual constructions? You know, you can design all you want, but if you don't have money for doing the construction,
yes. Yeah. Can you answer that?
Then it would be safe to say that you do the planning or the pre-design, but you wouldn't start construction until you had at least enough money to carry the project on. Any other questions from the members?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Trimble.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I see that it's Minneapolis and St. Paul. Do you have thoughts of going into are you having thoughts about going into the rural areas, and how close are we? We looked initially, when we talked about expanding
before, a few years ago. We looked at the data, what's going on besides the math achievement among kids in Minnesota, and we were looking at whether it was a possibility. And the Duluth students were nearly statewide average. However, the inner city students were way below. And so we wanted to go and have the greatest impact in the area of G was. And so we initially expanded from having two instructors to six now and expanded by turning some students. I think our current strategic plan is to expand a little bit more here in some cities, but maybe down the road we need to look at another location. But in the Twin Cities, because of the greater
any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll move into the next one, and that's World War II Memorial Dedication Ceremony, and that is on page 22. Mike Polisky, Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Again, that's on R22.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the representative. Is part of the cost of bringing the veterans to this? Could that be handled by the county veteran service offices? Have you looked into that? Or Mr. Representative, I guess, you know, my question was, you know, I mean, could a portion of that cost be covered by the county veteran service offices with the transportation facilities that they already have in place? That was kind of where I hope to go with that.
$5,000 for transport of veterans. So they're going to be coming to the table as well.
The American Community already dedicated $20,000 towards us for that match if it's okay with the bill. So we are getting a lot of sponsors and kind of donations coming forward. Now, without the transportation, which is by far the largest expense, the budget for the program is around $70,000, and that's with a lot of what we need to provide to us.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, I've got in my hand here the World War II Monument Dedication Estimated Budget. And I see in the House side of the bill here, of our side-by-side, is a $250,000 appropriation. And here it looks like $65,000 or $31,000. Well, I don't get the connection here between the $250,000 and what we got in this piece of paper.
What you have there is an expense estimate that's put in by our finance director that talks about all the other expenses we're looking at. It doesn't include the actual transportation costs at this point.
So the $250,000 is a separate item from this piece of paper here, okay.
To the Deputy Commissioner, well, first of all, I know transportation is a big cost because if you saw the news report last night on the Waconia group that headed to Washington today, I believe, for a one-day look at the World War II Memorial out there, and they're coming out. They found 121, I believe, veterans just around and in the city of Waconia. So even if the Veterans Service Office vans were able to run, and I'm suspecting some will, they certainly can't haul the number of people that they will need to with crutches and wheelchairs, in a lot of cases disabled folks. And the other interesting thing was they're also having doctors and nurses and stuff accompany a lot of these groups because some are from nursing homes and other things too. So there is a lot of specialized transportation. But just while we're on the subject, I see on the side-by-side, and this is a totally different question, but to the deputy, the Senate has a language in here that any money remaining in the donation matching account after the state share, et cetera, will go to services for programs for vets and their families. Do you have any idea? You're a month and a half away. You must have a somewhat idea. Are you going to have additional monies left over, and any idea on a dollar amount there? Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'm talking about on the Senate side, and it was the actual construction cost of the memorial. They've got language that once it's all done, and you're out there working right now, I know that, once it's all done and the state has paid their share and you've been soliciting donations to match state monies there too, it says additional money left over goes to programming for families and veterans. Do you know at this point, because you're nearing the end of construction, are you going to have some excess dollars in the construction fund? Mr. Chair, do you have any idea at all on dollar amount? Once construction's done, once the $250 is set aside, can you look out and tell me an estimate in the next year or year and a half on what you perceive that account balance will be that will be available for transfer to other things?
I noticed, I put a little fun in this meeting. We spent an hour talking about bathrooms. I'm glad that you got portable restrooms. Senator Coonsley.
Thank you. To the Deputy Commissioner, I guess to turn around and from the other side of the question asked a little earlier, you know, are you then counting, you know, the cost of counties who transport their own veterans, is that counted as a part of the match for the $250,000? I mean, it would seem to me that that would be a legitimate contribution from an outside source.
Mr. Chairman, we want to check with finance to make sure that that is appropriate, but we intend to use every source that we can towards that match.
Mr. Canal, can
you help? Well, Mr. Chairman, I just point out on line 19.11 on the House side, it does say in cash or in kind, so in kind would be those kind of services. It should fit.
I would guess, Mr. Knopf, that probably why they're checking is we do provide state dollars to county service officers, too, and we want to make sure that it should be matched with non-state resources.
Mr. Chairman, actually, that's a good point. It does go on to say by non-governmental sources, so it would even be local sources of revenue.
To me, like you got a pretty good schedule there if everything. Hope for nice sunshine and weather.
Mr. Chair, members, you know, we pick 2 9 days, it's pretty close to GA, which is 6, and typically that's the nicest week of the year weather wise. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. It should be a wonderful event.
Yes. Have you sent out so that veterans know that this is going to be that day because they plan to be here and there? That's sent out?
Mr. Chair, I'd ask that you get this out to legislators as soon as possible, too, because I don't know if everyone's seen the schedule, and because it's time to start marking the calendar, and we do that way ahead of time. Parades and things are already starting, and it'd be nice to know that this is out there. So if you could email this to the legislative offices, I think it'd be great, too.
Chair, members, we'll do that immediately.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
Coming today,
we're going to move into agriculture. The first one is going to be Jack B. Pedwanka Sioux Community, and there's a
Energy Sioux.
Energy, is that person with?
Yep.
That's on R10. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks,
Senator. I should mention that this is an addition. It wasn't on the original one, but you're not able to be here tomorrow, so we moved you in so we could accommodate you today.
Thank you. Could you state the page again, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Ruby. R10.
R10.
Bottom left side of R10.
One of the things they came to us with about 3 years ago was an idea that really I was completely fascinated to take it because it was a biomass heat generation, co-generation facility that, and those of you who serve with me on the Energy Committee appreciate this, it was not government mandated. They're joining because it makes good business sense. They partnered with our friends in the Washington Shakopee Sioux community to put together a biomass project to burn some of the waste agricultural products that they use, and they are subscribing for other waste products around the three cities. For a generation facility, which I believe is going to peak at about 12 to 14 megawatts of electric power and enough heat to replace all of the natural gas within their facility 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's enough natural gas to heat over 14,000 homes, and that natural gas now will be coming out of the natural gas system. It will be available in the natural gas system, of course, to heat cool homes in our area. The thing of moving forward with this process, they've been keeping us in the loop on how they're doing. They're doing this all with their own private money. And in a moment, I'm going to introduce Mr. Stan Ellingson from the Shakopee and Washington community, who is the manager of land and natural resources for the tribe. He's also their point person on the project. But they came to us here in the legislature early this year with a proposal that if the state would match on a 3-to-1 basis, 1/3 state, 3 parts private money, some money to build a test facility. Actually, what it would be, I guess, is a biomass fuel depot project somewhere in either Missouri or Scott County for handling biomass product that would be specifically farmed and marketed for this project. They would match it with 3 parts to 5 months for every single part of the public money that would be put in. To develop a standard, I guess this is one thing we're struggling with on the Energy Committee, is we see a lot of really great proposals coming down the pike for switchgrass or willow trees or this, that, and the other thing. One thing we have not done, however, folks, is we haven't standardized on what how we're going to transport it, how we're going to store it, how we're going to just do the logistics of that. And we're looking for some sort of a standard, sort of like the Society of Automotive Engineers puts together for things to do with automobiles or transportation. The folks at Coda Energy, which is where I'm all from, Washington, are proposing to develop this standard for us with their own dime, a little bit of public participation, and then make those standards available in the public domain so they won't be proprietary, but the things that they learn they're going to share with all of us in the rest of the state. That is the crux of the bill. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to introduce Mr. Ellingson about the project if you would.
Representative Beard, I apologize for not recognizing you, but it's hard for me to keep track of all of the new senators, and I don't know how long you've been there. It's possible for me to pick up everybody in the House, so I apologize for that.
And Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Roebling's a co-author in the Senate, is that not right?
Okay. Okay, let's hear from you. Danny Ellison, you want to add a little bit to it?
They can't make a profit.
building. We need to find a way where we can put a facility out in our country that's within transportation distance from our facility, that will provide a location for the farmers to go across, bring them there, where we can process them and store them and prepare them for use in the generation facility. And there's a lot of very specific things that need to be done to the fuels that have to be kept in a certain fashion, contaminated. Otherwise, whatever process they use to generate the energy, they're not going to work with them. They have the emissions problems and all kinds of other issues. And that's really what this specific project is to develop that facility, to develop a way for farmers to bring material and offload them, to process them, store them, and transship them out of the facility. And as Representative Beard said, we fully understand that we need to save money, the information that we generate, and the technology we generate is public information. Just the way it works.
We're in a new era now with all of the biomasses and everything that's coming to the front. I'm not going to talk about the money, but there's three or four of them that we're trying to put together kind of all around the state just to get some good ideas. I think it'll happen. Did I see somebody's...
I have a question. Now, just to follow up, I do like this project. These are the kinds of projects, members, that I envision our next-gen money's funding over the next 10 years or so, projects that we need the research and development on. As far as the fuel depot goes, though, obviously this is an important concept all over the state, how we're going to handle materials. Who are you working with for the research? Are you working with ag engineers and other logistical specialists? Are you working with the university, or who's helping you out with this? What kind of collaboration is going on with this project, if it gets going?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, a few times I've been in the Metrodome, I thought to myself, boy, this place could hold a lot of hay. and I suppose moving it out to farm country is not an option, but it would be nice if we could.
But it fit in there pretty well. On a serious note, Representative, there's all kinds of... My concern is let's not put all our research into one group. There should be other people in order to get all these things. Because all four or five of those are probably a little different situation. Any other questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
I just want to make a comment that, once again, this information will be public information, and I'll participate on the AURI roundtable discussion, too. So that's important, just like they said, to make sure that others can utilize the findings that they have there locally, that everybody in the state will have access to that information.
I would also mention, again, as I... You brought up the university, and I told members to keep in mind a lot of these projects are university and, in fact, MISA projects. I believe the Rosal Project, Don Wise, who works with MISA, is coordinating that. The White Earth Project is kind of a MISA thing, and I believe they're working with this also. So even though I just want to point out that even though maybe the money doesn't directly say MISA in some of these bills, we are indirectly funding some of the MISA work throughout this bill and other areas too. And in the higher ed bill also, there's more than one project in there that may overlap. So as we do our calculations at the end, we certainly want to have adequate funding for MISA and other things, but we also have to, I think, keep in mind some of these other projects we're funding that they're also involved with as we go forward, and I'm hoping we can get an accounting of that as we go also, because even though it doesn't say it indirectly, these are the projects that MISA has been working on out in the field.
Dr. Mjaki, I think you think the same way as I do. I don't mind putting money there, but I want some results. Right.
Yep.
Stack money just to kind of...
And I'd also say, like Representative Hamill said, not only are they making it public, they will be back to us in 2 years giving us a report on how these resources were used and where they're at, which I think is great for our committee process also.
Okay, members, we need to move along because we run a little bit late in the session today. So thank you very much. We'll go right into waste pesticide collection program, and that's on R31. President Taylor. Welcome to the committee, and Greg Bukicki, Pesticide and Fertilizer Division, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Why don't you just come up there, too?
I'm going to have to speed along here because we're...
So far, we got this room until I leave it. But just...
One time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, before they go again, also on page R59, R31 and R59, both pages, not all in one spot. So you're going to have to bounce around a little bit on this slide.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Introduce yourself. Not all the senators might know you.
Who have testified in the House and
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is John Zander, the Bull County Solid Waste Administrator. I'm the president of the Solid Waste Administrators Association. I'm happy here to testify before you on behalf of the Solid Waste Administrators Association and the Association of Mitchell County. Our concern on both county level and hazardous waste program, as well as since 2002, there's been substantial changes in the Minnesota Department of Hazardous Waste and Hazardous Site Program. Originally, it started out that the appropriations were at a $600,000 level, and that was later cut to $300,000, with about $50,000 going to the Department of Hazardous Waste. Previously, prior to the 2002 collection were offered in every county in the state of Minnesota every other year. In 2002, the collections were reduced to regional collections, which were less convenient for people to attend, harder to get to, and resulted in more participation in the lower numbers of self-help and participation reports since that time. After the budget cuts, the Department of Ag did offer counties through the Health and Hazardous Waste Program contracts to provide that service to meet the statutory requirement to provide waste pesticide disposal options in the state. The result of that and budget cuts were that a number of counties feared that the appropriation was not adequate to cover their costs, and as a result, 29 of the 87 counties have not signed that agreement and have not had the pesticide disposal service. Just one of the issues for counties in not signing that contract is that they were fear that the funds weren't to cover their costs, and companies who frankly don't want to cover those Department of Ag program costs of global tax dollars. They feel that there's a tax placed on gross sales of pesticides in Minnesota, and they should cover that program and should continue to cover the costs of that program. We have had conversations through the years with the Minnesota Department of Ag on and off, and unfortunately, we just haven't been able to work out our differences at this point. We believe that the pesticide volumes are still out there, and we believe that the then collections of Department of Ag did last fall. But there's that over the expected 60 some odd thousand pounds of pesticides to tend to all the collections in this 29 county area that has been served. So the Association of Minnesota Counties, our association, the Solid Waste Administrators Association, is supportive of the House language addressing the program, as well as the additional funds for the program and call for in that language, and the opportunity to participate in the second task force to come to a long-term solution as well. Thank you.
Department, have anything to add?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Director, my name is Francis again. I'm the Director of the Site for Western Management Group of the Department of Agriculture. The Department is very much supports Section 59, page number, but that is the task force report. The Department has been involved in waste pesticide collection since the Groundwater Protection Act. During that period of time, Minnesota farmers and pesticide users have successfully properly disposed of over 3.2 million pounds of this pesticide. This makes the state of Minnesota the third largest, the state that has the third largest amount of pesticide. Over the course of these programs, we have worked with household hazardous waste folks, administrators, in an increasingly cooperative fashion. So in 2003, we were concerned about the project. We actually sat down with household hazardous waste folks and worked forward an idea in which to transfer largely
program. It's a regional program that is a lot more efficient in cost. That program has had that mixed results. Some counties report that it works quite well, and the counties have not been participating. This particular issue was looked at closely by the Office of Legislative Affairs and Support, and they pointed out that the department had not been providing waste and pesticide collections, regardless of the degree of cooperation from the household hazardous waste folks. So the department actually went out and did some collections last year. We think that is very important for us to complete this task force and come forward with a redesign program in cooperation with growers, farm organizations, hazardous waste, and solid waste. We're very much a part of that. We do have concerns about the sections 19 and section 60. Those are above the governor's recommendations for revised. And we want to prove that you study first before putting additional resources in, which may go across problems. So, Mr. Chairman, I think you've got a question.
Any questions from the committee? No, thank you very much. We'll be looking at this as we go through the process here tomorrow. Next one up is residential. I'm going to try to pronounce this word, but I probably won't be able to do it. Antimicrobial pesticide applicator license. That's the only time I'm ever going to say that. R60. Representative Hansen, maybe you can, when you come up there, tell me how you pronounce that word.
And Matt, Mr. Chair, before they go, that last bill was also a SCOI bill, just for the senator's recollection. So if you're dealing with SCOI on some tax issues, if he's on that conference committee, you want to make sure you're telling him you're working on his bill over here. This one is the Sieben bill, along with Representative Hansen, who's at the table.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, members, legislature, and I need to work on the pesticide applicator license. This provision under Minnesota law, anyone who applies a pesticide for fire needs to be licensed. And that was the program I used to operate. And the license categories of applicators, turf environmental applicators, agricultural applicators, forestry applicators, rights-of-way applicators. But the recent years with the issue of mold contamination in homes. There's been a number of folks who hung up a shingle and started working antimicrobial applications in homes doing mold remediation treatment. And so what the purpose of my bill was, of Senator Sieben's bill, was to bring those folks into the same structure that commercial applicators or turf applicators, where they take the test, they prove their competency, they prove their continuing education. And so Bill directs the Department of Agriculture to develop a plan in conjunction with the University of Minnesota for moving in that direction. And so we have testimony in the Dumpy's committee from homeowners who have paid $2,000 for people to come in and spray their home for mold, and they still have mold. We want to try to get that measurement of competency. We've made some changes along the way. I'm not quite sure what happened with Senator Sieben's bill, but I would ask for your consideration to include this in the nominees.
Members, that's on R60.
Mr. Chairman, this was Senate File 956 under Sieben. It was heard in committee and sent to the Finance Committee, and I'm not sure what happened after it went. This was sent to us as a policy bill. We're a dual committee. And so it was sent to finance, but nothing happened after that. I honestly don't know why. But it was heard. There are just some slight differences. I think the House may have added a few, a little bit of language tying it in specifically to mold. Other than that, I think it's the language is pretty much identical to Senator Sieben's bill that was heard by the Ag and Veterans Committee in the Senate.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Hansen or Mr. Bozicki. Are the repealers on page 61 a part of this bill?
No.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Sir, do you probably have anything to add to it?
Mr. Chair, I would just say we're very comfortable with this. We have worked with the Department of Health and the University of Arizona plan moving forward with this setting this in reporting back. So we're very comfortable with it. We think it's a very permanent knowledge. And we do believe the report would be very helpful.
Well, it was in my younger years, nobody paid much attention to mold. But now that's a very important thing. In you can get sick as can be on just mold in the house. It used to be that way. Part of it was that way, but I don't know if they paid that much attention to it. But it's really, really coming to the front. Just throw a little bit of veterans issue in here. Look what happened out in Washington. Mold all over for those soldiers. So it is important. Any other questions? No, thank you very much. And we'll take it into consideration. Next, we're going to move into the Board of Animal Health, and that's on R16 and R17. Mr. Hartman, and members, I'm going to apologize. I told you yesterday at 3 o'clock I was going to bang the gavel down. I'm going to take as much time as it takes us to finish this.
Mm-hmm. We should.
They can wait for me. I had to wait for them. Okay, Mr. Hartman, let's go.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health. As a veterinarian and with the Spring Beauty Legislative Committee, I'm the Board of Animal Health and the Department of the Rigor Foundation. I'd like to start off with a couple of them, real briefly telling you what's been going on. First, I want to thank the governor and these two bodies, the House and the Senate, for recognizing the importance of the bovine tuberculosis in northwestern Minnesota. There are a lot of people that are counting on us to help them with solve this infection problem we found up there. We've worked very closely with USDA and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and DNR, and I think we've been making great progress. And one of the reasons we've been making this progress is, if you remember last session, we came to you for a supplemental appropriation of $685,000 to fight this problem, and that was delivered to the board, and that's what led to the success. To do this, we need people and we need resources. There's a lot of testing that's been going on. So far, we've identified 7 infected beef cattle herds, all in a fairly small area in northwestern Minnesota. They're about 41 miles apart, so they're pretty close together. That infection has all been eliminated from those herds, and most of those, 5 of the 7 herds are back in business and raising cattle again. During this effort, we've tested about 200,000 head of cattle in Minnesota, so there's a lot of testing activity going on, and much of the resources we're asking for are for that process of testing cattle. Also, whenever this infection is found now in the United States, we're required to look in wildlife to see if there's any infection there. We know in Michigan they have a problem in the wildlife, so when we looked, we found that there were indeed free-range and white-tailed deer in this area infected with this disease. We've confirmed at least 2 of these deer to be TB infected. There are others that are suspects now. So DNR has been working hand-in-hand with us to eliminate that infection, and they've had some sharpshooters up there. They've had a lot of good progress eliminating the disease in deer. There were 4 things really we're trying to accomplish this year in this session. The first was to find additional resources for TB. Second, to delete obsolete statutes that we have that provided indemnity for tuberculosis, brucellosis, and paratuberculosis. And if you're not familiar with that last disease, that's Joni's disease. And to delete some rules that the board had for bovine tuberculosis. The reason for deleting these and the reason they're obsolete is because it's been over 30 years since we've had this disease in Minnesota. The science has changed. We know more about the disease, so the rules are no longer applicable. And that indemnity, that was old language as well. And the amounts that were provided, the $37.50 for an animal, grade was not enough, and $75 for a purebred animal were not enough. So those, we're looking at eliminating those. We also wanted to come into compliance with the federal regulations for bovine tuberculosis. And finally, in a case where the federal government refused to pay indemnity for cattle that were suspects for this disease, the board would have the option of providing an indemnity at the proper, at fair market value. So maybe I'll just start with R16 and 17 that we're and say that what we request, what the Board of Animal Health requested through the governor was $448,000 for the first fiscal year and $363,000 for the second fiscal year, and those numbers are still what we estimate we would need to be able to deal with this problem in the next 2 years. In the House language, under 15.30, that was language that was delivered late, and there was no, because of that, there was no money attached to it. The situation that arose was we had we were testing up in that area. We found some animals that tested suspect, and the owner's options were to wait for 60 days under quarantine or sacrifice their animal at no with no reimbursement to get out of quarantine earlier. It was creating quite a few, and we were getting quite a few of these positive suspects. The federal government said they couldn't pay for it, and so that's what led to this language change on indemnity in the statute. Since that time, the federal government has gotten them to agree to pay for them. Whether they will continue, I don't know. So this language would at least allow us to pay for these animals if the federal government did not. Without any funding, we wouldn't have money to do it, but at least we have the money.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Hartman, the question we have as a committee here, the money is very close on page R16. The rider language is what's different. The question is, do you need all this breakout like we see in the Senate bill? We have minor breakout, 408 plus 408 and the 159. That's the only rider language we have. Or should we be giving you the money as per your request and allow you more flexibility? I mean, and certainly I'm concerned about pneumovirus in poultry, but here it specifically says 80 the first and 80 the second. Is that engraved in stone, or would you rather have kind of a block grant and allow the board to put the resources as they deem fit? Those numbers, you know, I don't know what they're going to be the second year, and if you do, that's fine. We'll put them in like this. But if you're looking for more of a block grant, could you advise us on that a little bit at this time? Because there's some fairly different rider language in both bills.
Way more than what's allocated to the program. So, for instance, for avian pneumovirus, we spend way more than $80,000 that's allotted for a lot of the year. So, it hasn't been a big issue. There could come a time when we didn't need as much for avian pneumovirus as we were getting, and we might need more for bovine tuberculosis or for Peyronie's disease or vice versa. So, yes, taking away that language would provide us with the option of allocating it to what we've got most important.
And Mr. Chair, to follow up, the only other question then is, I mean, we are going to need rider language, and perhaps perhaps our staff can come up with that. I see also under the avian, the different thing there is it also asks for in-kind dollar for dollar or in-kind matches. And perhaps is that something you still do? Is that still carried out? Does the industry, I assume they probably put in, again, way more than that, I would assume, but is that language important to you also?
Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, that language was not there from the beginning. It was added at some point along the line. I can't remember how many years ago, but yes, the poultry industry in this case provides way more resources than that, so it doesn't hurt anything. I don't know that it's doing any good. They would continue to provide those resources.
So, again, just to conclude, perhaps staff can think about maybe we can tighten this up a little bit and do one paragraph rider that maybe just indicates that this money is for, among other things, you know, Yanni's and pneumovirus and other things. So it's in there, and we're identifying it as a problem this year again, but not necessarily assigning specific dollar amounts might be helpful to them and us in the future, too, particularly if this goes into base and is forwarded. Might be helpful.
Chairman, Representative Junkie, these are base riders, and you probably are aware of that. We've been carrying these for a number of years now. And it just provides a minimum. It basically, they can spend more than these amounts on these purposes, but it guarantees that at least that much is going to be spent for those purposes towards activities. The one that's a little bit newer is on 12.1 on the Servidae. That was the general fund that gets added to the fees that they charge to run that program. Like I said, these have been base and carried for a number of years, though.
And again, Mr. Knopf and members, and I realize that. I don't have a problem with it. I have talked to the poultry folks, because this is usually the bill that I carry, and they're fine with giving more discretion without assigning dollar amounts. I guess I very much trust the Animal Board of Health also to use these resources where necessary. I mean, we never know what's going to come up from year to year, and without having to then come to the legislature and actually assign more money or move money if for some reason an emergency arose, I guess I'd tend to want to give them more flexibility rather than lock in dollar amounts year after year in the base, but that's my personal editorial on it.
Senator Kubi, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Hartman, you know, what are the reimbursements for on line 1530?
If those tests are in the suspect range, so they're not positive, they're not negative, but we're suspicious of them, those owners right now have the option of waiting for 60 days for another test, which in which time their whole herd is under quarantine or sacrificing their animal. And in a lot of cases, it's very difficult for these producers to stay under quarantine for 60 days, so they just assume sacrifice that animal, look at it, and get off quarantine. And this would provide for indemnity for those cattle if the federal government wasn't paying.
Okay, just a follow-up. Thank you, Ms. Sharon and Dr. Hartman. So is the repealer in Section 62, do some of those deal with the Board of Animal Health? Section 62.
The repealers all deal with the indemnity statutes that are current, and then also the Board of Animal Health rules in our chapter for bovine tuberculosis. So what essentially we're doing is deleting all of the statutes, the current statutes for indemnity for cattle, and then adding new language in to provide for this reimbursement.
Well, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hartman, so that is that new language then in this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dupuy, I don't know the issue.
And after you. Well, Mr. Chairman, if you look at page R46, that's actually, when you look at the appropriation language on R17, that section is a new section, 35.085, which is being created in page R46, and both sides carry the statutory language. The big difference is, of course, the House has the rule provision on in page, or that section 39 on page R46 in the House side.
Okay. sure that the Senate is saying yes. That's the new language on R46. It redefines how we move in.
Okay, Ms. Chair and Dr. Hartman, so when you comply with federal regulations, then that still allows you to cover the portions that you mentioned earlier that are not covered by the feds? Is that accurate? Okay, and Ms. Chair and Dr. Hartman, do the rules pertain to the board as well? So, Ms. Chair and Dr. Hartman, there are no new rules then that the department needs to adopt that would replace these rules that would be taken care of at the federal level? Ms. Chair and Dr. Hartman, I guess my concern is that we might be repealing rules before the new rules are in place, and you know it would seem wiser to me to have the new rules in place before we repeal the old ones, I guess, so that at least there was some coverage there for the department and for the state. Thank you.
Senator Hill.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Hartman, is there any part of the two bills on this side-by-side comparison that you would like to point out to us and express an opinion right now as to which language you prefer, or if you have any special issue with any language we got on one side or the other?
Somebody added the word professionally recognized test. And it's not on the host site. A better terminology might be, any official test and skip the professional you're recognized. Both state law and federal law talk about an official test. Also, the language about if we pay indemnity on cattle, if the cattle are mortgaged, how that gets dealt with, that has had several revisions. Senator Betzel pointed out that there were some problems with it in the Senate. And made some amendments to it, and then it got further refinement in the House. I'm a veterinarian, not an attorney, and I would trust that however that gets done best is fine with us. The intent is that we don't pay the owner the money on mortgage cattle, and then the bank doesn't get paid for their mortgage.
Mr.
Knapp.
Mr. Chairman, there's a slight difference in that the board has to conduct a lien search on the Senate side. On the House side, it says they're subject to 336A, which is the product licensing and financing statement provisions. And I think the way this is, the intent was in the House to do this is that the board then will be a buyer in the ordinary course of business, and the board would have to register with the Secretary of State's office and get the statements that come back from the people who finance. Is that, Mr. Chairman, I was just asking the witness, is that how this is going to work? Mr. Chairman, it just seems that this might be enough language to do it, but I guess the key is that they'll just need to register under Chapter 336A to get those financing statements or list those people.
Mr. Knapp, maybe you could kind of do a little fine tuning between now and the time we get.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this may be adequate to do that. I just want to make sure.
Mr. Chair, just back to the money page again. The only difference is in the money, 408 plus 408, 448 plus 363 is actually the house is $5,000 more for whatever reason. So the money isn't the big problem. I guess I'm just going to confirm the split there. Is the split of that money important? You have 448 the first year, 363 the second, and the house basically splits at 50-50 one year and does that matter, or as Senator Dill was asking some of the layout here, is that important or not?
Mr. Curran, Representative Junkie, yes, it is important. We anticipate greater costs in the first year, and we can carry money forward, but we can't spend it.
All right. Chairman, just to point out to Resident Junkie, that also you do have that line that says of this $159,000 is permanent. The Senate did keep the entire 363 in the base without there was some concern that when they received the money last year that they wouldn't be coming back this year for money, and they came back this year again, that maybe it should be left in the base for a while until this situation gets cleaned up.
Again, follow up on that then. Obviously, this was in the Olin bill in the House. Is that what you're estimating that you want put into the base, or is it considerably more like the Senate side?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunkey, as best we can estimate, that's what came through the governor's office is what we would need in the out years. it's a change, ever-changing situation up there. Right now, we just finished with test the sharpshooting event with the deer. They've got 480 deer in that core area, and they identified six animals that were suspicious, four that were highly suspicious. So we're finding more infections. It's a little unpredictable what the cost will be in the out years, but that's the best we can estimate.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Hartman, there's money over in the environment bill on this too, particularly as it deals with the deer side of it. Are you you're coordinating with them at that point too? And their resources look like they're. You've been tracking it over there too. They're in good shape there.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much. And we'll move into the last one, and animal husbandry. And that's in our 56 and 57. Mr. Lee McGrath, Executive Director of the Institute for Justice. And Dr. John King, Executive Director of the Board of Veterinary Medicine.
Well, introduce yourself and realize I know Senator Vickerman, he'll be right back, but he gave you some guidelines. Each side of this has 10 minutes to present however you want, and so it's 3:30 right now, and you got. I see you brought up a crew, and that's why I'm saying realize you've got 10 minutes. You can use it as you see fit.
Practice on both sides of this vertical line. and farmers and animal owners can freely choose their providers on the right side of the vertical line. The rationale for doing this bill is first and foremost consumer choice. Farmers and owners know what is best for their animals and what they can afford in terms of animal husbandry. Secondly, the second rationale is that similar procedures should be treated similarly. The bill's husbandry skills are similar to the exempted castration, dehorning, and tail docking. Thirdly, the bill does not take away veterinarians' abilities to provide animal husbandry. It opens up husbandry market for rural providers. Fourth, the bill does not change veterinarians' legal monopoly over veterinary medicine. They continue to have control over the left side of that important, where there's important surgery, diagnosis, and disease treatment going on. And finally, this bill is consistent with the legislature's occupational licensing policy in section 214. Let me now turn it over to Dr. Mike Pierce.
Welcome to the committee.
Of
That's right, it's people. My regular veterinarian, my horse trainer, my chiropractor, my massage therapist, my keyboard, all the way down to the room. People are all critical in maintaining the best health possible for all of my animals, so that they can perform at the highest possible level they can, much like a professional athlete would. Several years ago, I had a number of deterioration of my teeth, so I was just going to have to do it with a I guess the board of veterinarians that the services he was providing did follow the veterinary services, and that he was actually stopped, which was a very concern of mine. My veterinarian was not willing to do teeth for me. Too much work. Frankly, I had much more important things for her to do before she left the farm. I only had so many hours with them, so it's important that I use them a lot. I believe some legislation went through back long, sorry, a couple of years ago in order to become a grandfather to bring that to me. Based on his experience and stuff like that, it's still limited how they people are performing that path. I guess that was my team went back to that, so I was kind of happy. More recently, the second member of the team, Dr. Pierce, was ordered to stop performing services as well. So as you see, there's been a deterioration of my team on the team over here. It's almost like the board just decides, well, all of a sudden, okay, that's going to be the service that we want to stop. I'm concerned that it's going to continue on to my other members as well. I need the team to be prepared. It's taken me a long time to assemble them, and I feel that they're the very best that they can, you know, perform the very best services to my animals. I've already noticed a significant detrimental effect on the health of my horses with the loss of Dr. Pierce. I guess I'm here today to try to restore my team. One that I'm not going to work very hard to fill. Well, the freedom to choose who I feel is best qualified to work on my horses, whether that was vet or a groom, and all people. I believe that all horses and animal owners can sort of decide who is qualified to work on their animals.
All the people who are advocating for this legislation have to speak utmost respect for veterinarians. They're an important component of providers. What this bill does is gives greater choice to consumers on issues where there are lower skills and lower risk than what the legislature has already identified as acceptable. Castration, and we ask for your support, and we'd be happy and we're pleased to join Farmers Union in asking for that support. And we'd be happy to answer any questions you have now or after our colleagues in the veterinary board speak.
Yeah. I think that's we'll hear from the other side, and then we'll hold the questions and then stick around and we'll call you back if we. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dr. John King. I'm the director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. Had an interaction with most of you previously. The language in this bill presents some concerns. I just wanted to discuss that with you. But first, the Board of Veterinary Medicine understands that animal owners want a choice for who provides health care for that for their animals. And they also want to acknowledge and recognize that that choice may not be veterinarians. That's not necessarily a view that's shared with the State Veterinary Association. But giving that choice to the consumer, the board feels it's really important that those people that are in the pool of candidates who can provide health care have three things. And that is some minimum training to match the task that's going to be done, some objective way of evaluating competency, and some accountability. In this bill, those things are not provided for and eliminate things that are already in law. There's some of the language in this is problematic. There's incomplete definitions, and some of it is not specific enough. It is huge burden of interpretation, and it's problematic, and it's going to create problems down the line. And I'd be happy to go through a few things that jump out that say, we need to think about this, because when we're talking about a broad topic like animal chiropractic or insemination, you don't always consider all the species that's going to affect. Specifically, animal chiropractic says only working on the vertebral column. Individuals that have chiropractic care on their animals have more than just the vertebral column. They have knees, hips, backs, shoulders done as well. It's incomplete and non-inclusive. And then it's allowing individuals with motor training. Any of you around the table could go out tomorrow and call yourself an animal chiropractor and start doing this with no repercussions and no surgical training. Artificial insemination has been around for 50 years in dairy cattle. It has always been something that has been part of the animal producer. They determine when it needs to be done. The technician comes and puts the semen in the cow or in the pig. That's never been on the topic of the Board of Veterinary Medicine. However, when you get into other species, which is not defined here, dogs require surgical insemination. Dogs are in heat, and horses are in heat for multiple days. Dogs 2 weeks, horses 5 days. There becomes a need for determination of when that animal needs to be bred, whether that's a laboratory test, some procedures, and those kind of things. So it's creating problems in and of itself, and concern, and endangering what is the foremost in policy, and that's protecting the animals and people living. Okay? At the very end, where it says other treatments similar or less risk requiring similar or less formal veterinary education employed to maintain domestic animals in good health is really a really problematic, undefined, open to huge interpretation, and who's going to end up deciding that? And that's a big concern. Mr. McGrath is, we've all seen the chart that draws this vertical line. The concern is that we don't know particularly, I don't know how it's determined that these other things to the right of the line and how they were determined to be there, and the ones left of the line were not. I believe it was determined, it could be arbitrary, and what suits the group. We also need to remember that Mr. McGrath and his client are suing the state of Minnesota, saying that the laws the legislature has passed is unconstitutional. That case is due to go to court in September. In providing this bill, bringing that trial that to court before the legislature, passing this bill will not allow that to be judged by a judge in a court of law to determine if the laws are constitutional or not. And it is circumventing the process.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, my name is Tom Hager from Vermarion, have been for a long time, and I'm representing the Minnesota Medical Association with almost 2,000 members. The Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association is opposed to this bill, opposed to it for many of the reasons that Dr. King pointed out. For example, it does not require training and allows anybody to do any of these procedures. Now, one of the issues brought up was artificial insemination. And as Dr. King pointed out, technicians have been doing artificial insemination for at least as long as they have. Also, the chiropractic fee. The fact is that anybody who has this bill along with one chiropractic
not need to be green. I think what veterinarians understand is that we're working not with the inanimate objects, but with living, being things, our animals. And our animals really deserve more. They deserve being sure that the people working on them have the training, have the competency, and have the accountability. And this is what licensure does, is provide those three tenants. I'll also point out that there's many diseases of animals that are zoonotic, or diseases that affect humans and animals. We see rabies in animals not infectious. Rabies present a lot of different signs, and one of them is the sign of the inability to walk, or problems with locomotion, problems with the back, etc. Not all animals with rabies are crossing in the top. Most of the rabies that we see in animals is what we call dumb form of rabies, and really needs to be diagnosed. The other thing that I will say is that not only is the Veterans Medical Association opposed to this bill, also the Minnesota Court Council opposes it, as does the Minnesota Association of Equine Practitioners. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please, right on time.
They got up 2 more minutes if they want.
2 more minutes. If you're going to talk 2 more minutes, otherwise, I'm going to open it up now for questions. Senator Gill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I don't see anything wrong with the law that we passed last year, which allows for people that are interested in getting into equine teeth floating to get into the business, but they have to get trained first. There's a provision in state law that we put in 2005 that grandfathers in Jim Johnson because of his long-term experience, even though he practiced veterinary medicine illegally for many, many years, and that's a gross misdemeanor. We made an exception for him to make him legal, and that was fine. I supported that. But then for others that want to get into the business, we have a training provision in there. I'd like to know what's wrong with that. For heaven's sakes, today we decided that, and we didn't decide yet, but the House has already decided that you don't want people going out there and treating moldy houses without being licensed as a pesticide applicator. And maybe Mr. McGrath or some of these other people here would you like to hire somebody that doesn't know what they're doing to take care of the mold in your house? Wouldn't you feel better if they were trained? And we're supposed to be the education state here. We pride ourselves in being educated. I'm sitting next to a nurse here, and she has ongoing continuing education credits, as I do as a veterinarian, and Pastor Kubley over here has ongoing continuing education credits he has to take. And all we're saying in state law is if you want to float horses' teeth, get yourself trained, there'll be some continuing education requirements. And I think the existing law is just fine. So that's what I'm supporting. And on top of that, we did such a good job in 2005 that I have 2 statutes here, one from Arizona and one from Virginia, that deals with equine dental technicians. And it's kind of interesting that both these states have passed a law that's very similar to what we have. They're going to allow these equine dental technicians to operate, but they need to get themselves trained. It's a continuing education credit requirement, and these 2 laws were passed since we passed ours in 2005. So I'm supporting what we've got in current law. Let Jim Johnson do it. He's got a lot of experience. He's qualified. He's an expert on it. He's got a good way about him. People like him. Let Jim Johnson keep doing his thing. But for additional dental technicians, equine dental technicians, let's require some training. It's the Minnesota way.
Ariella Kemba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would the training entail?
Well, I'm going to let Dr. King answer that question because he's the one that should know.
Can you train for the equine teeth order? The training can be several different ways, but it's in the law, 156.075, requires certification by an independent, objective body that evaluates vocational competency. And the training can be obtained in many ways. You can go to a formal school. There are equine dentistry schools throughout the nation. You can get it through apprenticeship. with others. You can do it by self-taught. You can do it in many different ways. There's no requirement on how you train. The requirement is proving proficiency for equine dental technician. What they use in other states, call the other states.
To be fair, come up there. Whoever else wants to.
Chairman of the Center for Trauma, Dr. King is correct that the prior law, which passed 2 years ago, recognizes the International Association of Equine Dentistry. However, what he doesn't say is that in order to get certification from the International Association of Equine Dentistry, you have to go through a gatekeeper who's already a member of the International Association of Equine Dentistry. And there is none in Minnesota. It's a small organization that has only 300 members based in Denton, Texas. So it is practically impossible for a new equine teetotaler to be certified by this organization that the statute recognizes. And as I understand from the discussion 2 years ago, it recognized late one morning.
Mr. Chair,
I'm going to go back to Mary Ellen if you have a follow-up.
My other question is, I know that veterinarians get their degrees, but how many of them take classes on teeth floating? And not only classes, but are certified, because I talked to some of my friends who are veterinarians, and they never took the class when they were in school, and they wouldn't know how to do it. So can you help me? Maybe I should add, so can they float teeth even though, just because they're a veterinarian, or do they have to go through the training also?
That's a compound question with many parts to it. Veterinarians that practice in equine medicine take classes in equine teeth, plus all veterinarians. Have a basis of anatomy, physiology, and how the tooth is developed, which is imperative in doing a good job about hurting them. Veterinarians can do it. They also are accountable for their actions. And if they're incompetent, they lose the ability and they have repercussions on their license. So I'm not finished with that. I prefer not to try this case in the legislature as well. With regard to the guild-like organization of the IAED, the board also has the ability to recognize other professional dental associations. There's been no request by anyone. In the last 5 years, over 50% of the individuals that have applied to take the certification test through the IAED, over 50% of them were sponsored by someone in another state. And those individuals, there's never been a complaint from anybody that has applied to take a certification exam that they could not find a sponsor, or could not get a sponsor. That is the truth as of today.
Mr. Chair, representing Otrema, in 2004, the 90 graduates from the University of Minnesota's Veterinary School, only four of those graduates went into large animal practice. The law does allow any veterinarian, regardless of his training, that veterinarian may have significantly fewer hours of training than a lay equine dentist. But despite not having any training, the law does allow him to practice equine teeth floating. But what the law stops is someone who does have that training, who has learned it informally, learned it transferred from father to son. And it stops people like Cindy Hickey, who is a certified nurse practitioner, from also engaging in animal husbandry in the area of massage or chiropractic. So this is a freedom to work, freedom of choice for consumers bill, and it is consumers who have the ultimate authority to an ultimate power to impose accountability.
Senator Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer Representative Otremba, because this is my answer on it. As a veterinarian, you learn a lot of things that you never use. Because when you get out of school, you wind up focusing on certain species, certain diseases, certain types of practice, but you've got that broad background in anatomy and chemistry and physiology and how to use certain types of surgical tools, and the dental issues are somewhat similar from species to species. And I'm sitting next to a mental health nurse here, and she probably learned a whole bunch of your mental health. She learned a lot of things in nursing school that she never uses either. But she focuses on the brain, the psychology and the psychoses and all the things that go wrong with our brain. That's her specialty. Somebody else may get out of veterinary school and specialize in mammary gland diseases. They're a dairy production specialist. Or they might specialize in canine hip surgery or something. But you've got that broad educational background, and if you want to get into equine dentistry, you've got that broad background so that you can read the book, you can take some classes, you can see some videos, and go out and do a pretty good job. We have this continuing education credit that we have to have. I have to have 40 hours every 2 years to renew my license. I just did on March 1st. So if you're going to get into equine dentistry and you've got to have 40 hours of training anyway, for heaven's sake, you're probably going to take classes in that area and specialize in it and read up on it and so forth. Mr. Chairman, members, the bill before us does not provide for any education. As a matter of fact, it takes away the educational requirement. What you've got in this bill here is you're saying that all 5 million Minnesotans can start practicing veterinary chiropractic, equine dentistry, and I think that's outrageous. This is an education state. If we're going to have people sticking their arms up people's horses' mouths and examining their teeth, they ought to have a little training ahead of time.
Hamilton, I'm Representative Hamilton, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I do. On this sheet that was passed out, risk to animals and acquired skills, my first question is, how are the risk levels in this chart determined? My second question would be, do the veterinarians agree with the risk levels on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Personal experience. I mean, I'm looking at the chart and I'm listening to the testimony, and we want to have the owners and the animals' best interest at heart. And I've done castration, dehorning, and docking. I'm not trained. Learned it at the side of my father. Do it for neighbors. Neighbors come and do it for me. If I had horses and they needed their teeth floated and my neighbor knew how to do it, I would guess I would let him do that. We understand the value of the animals we're working with. And we're not about to put livelihood in jeopardy. I guess when I think of castration, dehorning, and docking, it doesn't get much more invasive than that. I would rather have somebody who's certified on that end of the animal than on the other end. But we know what we're doing. You may disagree with me that I don't know what I'm doing, but we've done hundreds of them and we don't very often have a problem. I mean, you would have to agree with me that floating is less invasive than castration.
Not necessarily. Putting a rubber band on the testicles of a calf versus putting a carbide chip steel float in a horse's mouth and even fractures. I think there's a difference in, and those are things that are not on. They're not addressed.
Members, we're going to wrap this up here pretty quick. First, I'm going to go to Representative Cornyn, you have a question, and I'll come back to you, Representative Hamilton.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I know time is limited, and we have testifiers here who won't be here later. I would like to hear the horse owner's view on all of this. I'm sorry I missed your name. But
thank you. I didn't know what to do. Hearing all this, Chairman, I'm not even sitting here. And all due respect, I take offense insinuation that my animals deserve anything better than me. I would welcome anybody to come to my farm and see what my animals get. It's phenomenal. And I truly believe that animal owners in Minnesota are capable of deciding what's best for their animals. I would challenge anybody to contend that about the health of my animals. I mean, I've had people joke that they, when they die, they want to come back as a baby horse or a baby dog. So, you're going to be totally targeted. You're breaking up my team. And this is a team that comes together very differently. And they work together a lot. They all talk to each other. And they do absolutely what's best for my horse. And that's just what we do. That's why I have horses. Certainly, I would never put anything at risk with my horses, and deciding who chooses that should be mine. And if my money I'm paying people to do this for, why don't I get the choice to do this? That's what I'm here for. I should be able to choose. I get to choose whether I use a good vet or a bad vet. I get to choose whether I use a non-vet or a vet. And they just decided not to want to go to teeth floating was, you know, encompassing the precautionary bill. It's so broad, it could incorporate grabbing a horse's legs because that's preventative of injury. Or my horse trainer, who I would say, you know, prevents mental disability. So it's so broad, they can just decide whenever they want. That's something that's going to have to be done by a vet.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess my point through all this, it was a two-part question. I was asking what the veterinarians felt as far as this risk to animals and required skills. As Senator Scogin pointed out pretty well, I mean, I've also done a number of these things as far as castration, dehorning, docking, artificial inseminating. I'm a production person. And I was just wondering if you felt the same way, that this chart describes these items, that floating would take less skills than some of the castration, the artificial inseminating, et cetera. So that's my question for the veterinarians.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On this chart, you know, this is arbitrary, very arbitrary. It depends on who's doing it. It depends on the animal that is doing it. I would start comparing floating at least. Artificial insemination, you're a production person, you know about artificial insemination in swine. I was going to say earlier that I've been a veterinarian 27 years. Veterinarians have never thought that they were the people who do the artificial insemination. It's been in cattle for 50 years, in swine needs to go on 35 and 35 to 45 years. So, but I don't know if that is that well for skilled jobs. I mean, so I think this idea of over skills is not really a good comparison idea. Somebody came up with everything that makes a difference is the animal you're working on and the person who's doing it. And while people have identified very competent people, such as Jim Johnson, think of all the people out there that don't have any idea what competent is. And now you would let anybody, you don't put floodgates, so to speak, and let anybody do anything with anything. I just don't think that's good legislation. I just don't think it's good business. And the animal owners would do that, but in my years and practice, there's an awful lot of people that don't know what's going on.
Representative Hamill, you have a follow-up?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bill.
Well, the last discussion just brought to me, or reminded me of one thing I was going to mention today, is that on your own animals, of course, you can do almost anything. You can deliver like the young and castrated dog, and you can do that for your neighbors, and there's very little restriction. Just the common practice of animal production gets you involved in hoof trimming and doing all kinds of things. An animal bolts out there and you can't get a stomach tube down his throat, you maybe want to put a knife in the left side of the bovine animal to let the gas out and so forth. There's lots of things that happen on the farm that you learn how to do. But I was just going to get back to the gentleman from Buffalo that talked about how he knows who he wants to hire and so forth, and let the horse owner be the person that chooses, and the horse owners of the state of Minnesota know who to choose. I believe you are probably a very good producer, and so you probably know how to choose pretty well. But as Dr. Haggerty said, there's a lot of people that have livestock in the state that may not know anywhere near as much as you know about it, so it'll be kind of maybe tough for them to make the correct decision. But if they had a pool of trained tooth floaters out there, or animal chiropractors, you could choose from that pool, and you'd probably have a better chance of getting a pretty good person. But getting back to an earlier bill again, residential antimicrobial pesticide applicator license, I don't think we could say that all the homeowners in the state of Minnesota know how to pick their antimicrobial pesticide applicator. It'd be nice to have somebody that's trained, licensed, ongoing education, so when I call somebody up to come out and kill the mold in my house, I have a better idea that they know what they're doing. I think it's not a reasonable statement to say that the horse owners of this state know how to pick a team that can take care of their livestock, just as we can't say the homeowners of this state know who to pick. We're trying to help them pick somebody that's at least trained. And it's the Minnesota way, for heaven's sakes. We like education. We're a great state because of education. What in the world is wrong with having some education for animal chiropractors, equine tooth floaters, before they start going out there and making money on somebody else's livestock? If they want to do it on their own, that's one thing, but on somebody else's livestock, for heaven's sakes, let's give them some training first. And that's what the current law requires.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just some comments as we bring this to a close for today. This is an interesting topic in that We have people on both sides here that were authors of the bill, and probably people on both sides that are kind of against the bill. So defending a House or Senate position on this is becoming extremely difficult as I watch what's going on here. I'm just going to make some observations and then a suggestion for the next couple of days and just see how that works. First of all, I have a couple questions, and then I'm going to make my observations. What is the court case in September? So it's on teeth floating. I understand. I just want to clarify that. What to the veterinarians, does the veterinarian practice laws and statutes actually exclude by name massage or farriery or any of the other things in here? Does it actually exclude that by name, or are we defining something, you know, on the other side that we're saying should be not assumed to be veterinary? Or is it actually specified all these things in here that only veterinarians can do them?
Mr. Chair, a couple comments. The lawsuit goes beyond just being able to pull teeth. It's that the need for having some training is unconstitutional and it should be done.
Sure.
So it's a little more broad than just letting do. Second thing is that montage, artificial insemination, superior work is not addressed in the veterinary statute. It's not addressed at all. We're adding things into it. It has not been addressed and not had any complaints or dealt with by the board. They're
not issues. Okay. So that answers my question. I think a lot of people have made a lot of good points, and I agree with some of the points on training. I actually do agree with that I think there should be some level of training for some of these things. You know, I don't know about putting horseshoes on a horse or that type of thing if we need to. I think there are skills that can be picked up. I frankly think, my opinion, animal chiropractic is the manipulation of skeletal structure and muscles and other things, as opposed to massage, which we all massage our cats and dogs at home every time we pet them. So, you know, I think there's some levels and some different, this bill is encompassing a lot of different level of things, and I think there are some things in here that I don't think the Veterinary Association would disagree with. And I think there are some things in here that if we could define a little better, for example, if veterinary chiropractic included chiropractic work done by licensed veterinarians or licensed chiropractors that are out there now, which is who we heard from, your licensed chiropractor at this point in time. Just answer if you are or not. Right. So again, but then we go beyond and say anyone can manipulate muscles and skeletal structure by this bill. And I'm not taking sides one way or another. I'm just making some observations. So I guess it's my request, and I would thank this co-chair Vickerman too, that that maybe some of you all could talk over the next couple of days and see if there's any. The purpose of this committee is going to be try to find middle ground on some of this stuff, and this is one of them. And if we can't, what you're probably going to do is force Vickerman and Junkie to come with a proposal of their own at some point in time that probably none of you will like. I'd rather have Kubli and Scogan and Dill and Otremba and Conan, and maybe some of you folks sit down and see if you can't sort through this and understand a little better. I've learned some things, frankly, Representative Otremba, since you had the hearings in your committee, and I've had some different thoughts. And we heard this bill all night long, members. For those that wonder how the House is doing on this, I asked the CA here if we could go all night just for old time's sake on this. So, but I do think a lot of this bill is good, and I think it has merit. But I think there are some training aspects perhaps involved in certain aspects of this bill, and maybe some tighter definitions on things like chiropractic and some of that, where you could come out with a win and do a lot of this husbandry stuff and start defining some of this, or agree that maybe parts of it need more work, that we can draft up a bill before the end of session to introduce to work on it over the interim or next year also. Agreeable to the Senator Dill and others. So I want to make that point, and I know Mary Ellen's kind of wanting to say something here. So. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have emails from people in my district that, and one of my concerns is the fact that we have a shortage of veterinarians in rural Minnesota already. And that's some of the things that they're saying, that they, we do. It's a shortage. And so they're using their veterinarian for medical pieces, but they're finding somebody else to do that because these veterinarians, first of all, they don't have time because they're very busy because there's a shortage. And so we have to be careful how we draft this so that we don't take this teeth floating totally away from people in our districts who have really good horses. And we have to look at that piece. So that's kind of my last hurrah. That the concerns that I'm getting is it's hard to, we wait a long time for a veterinarian because of the emergency things that go on first, and so we have to be careful about making sure that these horse owners who are very capable of making their own decisions. I have two nieces that are really into horses. In fact, one of them got an award, an FFA award the other night. And they're 17 and 18, and they know who to pick for their horses. So I just want to remind everybody that Minnesota is different.
Yes, again, I just reiterate, if Senator Coogley and Torin, who are the authors of this bill, could continue to think about and work with folks over the next couple of days and see if there's any way we can massage this legislation a little bit and make it more acceptable for this time and place, and just have those discussions for our sake and the sake of this committee, I'd appreciate it.
We might be getting off track just a little bit because we put this together.
Right.
So, my side, we're not taking any stand whatsoever. Sir, I did hear this.
I can appreciate that, but two of your members here are authors, and they're taking the House's side right now, so we're...
Bill Ruth has it. I'll take some to the woodshed. No, seriously, maybe there's some of the ones some up above. I don't believe there's anything more. We could spend all night doing this, and I'm not going to do that. So I'm already.
Our schedule tomorrow.
You get the tomorrow.
Tomorrow, I think we're meeting at. We'll be tentatively meeting at 4:00 tomorrow. Again, depending on House or Senate, we're going in at 9:00 and doing the smoking bill and some other calendar items. So I assume we'll be done by 4:00, starting at 9:00. But keep an eye on both House and Senate, because if either of us are in session, obviously it'll go till the last body adjourns. Tomorrow we're going to be looking and taking testimony, again, short, I hope, hour and a half, 2 hours, so we're done by supper time, on next gen. And the other renewable and biofuel sections in here that are different. And anything else that between now and then, please talk to Mr. Michaels or Ms. Beyer and see if you can't get yourself on the schedule. We may have time tomorrow for some others. So, hang on.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to mention that we do have this room. Consistently, so if you'd like to leave it's here, that would be just fine. And we requested a summary of one-time appropriations. We have that. Perhaps fiscal analyst can go over that tomorrow.
Okay. Anything else? Not where